Hi, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut, what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
In this episode of the RUP, I sit down with former Sky presenter and international hockey player Nick Rothwell. Nick battled with alcohol and cocaine addiction for over 10 years, after he could never quite find the buzz he used to get from playing hockey. Alcohol and drugs became a crucial support, allowing him to hide his mounting issues. His relationships broke down, his work suffered, and he was chronically unhappy with his life, until he went to rehab and sorted himself out. Nick has now been sober for some time, and is thriving, setting up a mental health startup, ReTribe. ReTribe help people find their tribes, or communities, as Nick passionately believes that one of the greatest ways to solve mental health issues is to bring together people to form relationships and connections. I love his work, and I massively recommend people taking a look at ReTribe. Such an awesome idea. Anyway, enough from me. Here is Nick's story. So please, as always, leave all judgment at the door.
Nick, thanks for joining me, buddy.
You're welcome, brother. Hope you're having a good day.
Yeah, it's been a hot one, but yeah, we're getting there now. How's things with you? How are you coping with lockdown?
Do you know what? I'm actually doing okay. I feel like years of disconnection and isolation has prepared me for being alone in my flat and you know, not having any human contact. I'm actually okay with it. I've managed to, you know, stay really connected through these Zooms and you know, my brothers around me and family and stuff, and things are like, I don't have any complaints, put it that way. I am saying I'm overly friendly to people when I walk through the park. It's kind of funny. I'm in my class, so I'm like, "Hey, how are you?" And I'm slowing down, and maybe they'll have a conversation at 2 meters with me. But then there's a couple of trees that I can give a hug to, so I'm okay.
Funny you say hug a tree. I literally had a guest on the podcast literally about 3 hours ago who said one of the things he loves to do is hug trees. So, I mean, yeah, seemingly within the male mental health community, there's a penchant for hugging trees. So,
they're pure energy, right?
That is true.
As long as you got to get the right one though. There's a couple that have growing on them and the sun shining on them. I'm not hugging a cold tree. I need a warm, soft one.
We met through a friend of a friend, actually, who put us in touch because she goes, she said that you've got an amazing story, and you do. So one which has spanned from being a pro hockey player coming to the UK and then moving into journalism, but really completely losing your way with your mental health and then rebuilding. So enough of me talking. I'm very keen to share this one with listeners. So, where's your story begin?
My story begins right at the beginning. You know, I was born in a small town in southern Saskatchewan, in the middle of Canada. Very small town to two English immigrants from South Yorkshire. My father was a teacher, and my mother was a young mother with my sister, who was two at the time. And my father took this decision to raise a family in a small coal mining village and take a chance and to go to Canada. So what I do know now, though, is that there was a lot of family strife even at that time. And my dad was an active alcoholic, and he was taking, you know, he was going to a safe place where he could probably get away with a lot more. So, James, you know, the story is that I grew up in a family that had a lot of love, you know, but at times was very, very scary, you know, and my mother and father did their best. But, you know, when your dad is drinking as much as my dad did, and, you know, he would get violent and it was scary, you know. So, you know, when you're 4 or 5 years old and you see your father being violent to your mother and your two sisters, you become scared of him. And that's what happened. You know, I would urinate my pants when this guy walked in a room, and I was a bedwetter until I was 12 or 13 years old. I always thought it was, you know, that's weird, but it was because I grew up at the core of my existence was this scared person, you know? So when you're so scared, you do things to try to not be scared. And those are crazy things. A lot of people think they're really weird. They're defects, but they're actually defense mechanisms, which is lying and fantasizing and manipulating and stealing. You know, stealing was a really big thing. Like my mom and dad taught me that stealing was wrong, but yeah, I would go into the corner shop and I would come out with candy in my pocket. I think it gave me some kind of power, some kind of agency, you know. But I grew up into an athletic body, and my dad, like, he was a rugby player, so he was a tough guy, and I got on with the toughest sport in Canada that you could, which is ice hockey. And you know, I played to a pretty good level. It was like a little bit above average, but I wanted to, I played other sports too, like, you know, American football and proper football, and I boxed and I wrestled, and those sports kept me out of the house, and it gave my father's, gave me my father's approval. And then when I was 18, I had a chance to come over to the UK and play hockey. And, you know, it's professional in that you get paid. The standard wasn't, you know, the greatest of standards, but it was fun. And it was just great to be part of a team. And we did a lot of winning and a lot of bonding. And that's kind of where, you know, I never drank or did drugs because I didn't want to be like my dad. So, you know, I had a team around me that, you know, they kept you accountable. And you know, you had that sense of belonging. So being part of a team gave me that thing that I didn't have in my family. It gave me like connection and community and accountability. And you know, when you're playing ice hockey in the UK, you have to practice really late at night, you know, 11 o'clock on a Tuesday or a Thursday in a rink that was really damp, and you didn't want to go. I was going to university too at the same time, and you didn't want to go, but because you're part of a team, you know, you don't want to let the guys down. And that's the big thing about accountability that I talk to today a lot, you know, in corporate environments and sporting environments and family environments, accountability is so, so important. But then I stopped playing the sport that I loved and I started working for Sky Sports, and all of a sudden I was found myself like 28 years old, you know, working in advertising, working in broadcasting. Like I had, you know, a live TV show that I was the face of, and I had a pretty actress girlfriend. I had a flat on the river in Chiswick. You know, I had a Porsche. I had all these things that I thought would make you like me, you know, but inside I felt like a fraud and I felt like an imposter.
Why did you feel like that?
Just because I felt like I didn't deserve any of it. You know, I felt that there were people that were far better qualified. I felt, you know, I didn't have an education in broadcasting. I bullshitted my way into Sky. It was a lie that got me into Sky Sports. You see, lying got me a lot of stuff. And you could say, oh, Nick, everyone lies on their CV and everyone does that. But, it's still a lie is a lie. And when you're lying and there's no consequences for it, you're going to keep doing it. And that's why I felt like a fraud, because I had charmed my way into a life, you know, and I felt like I didn't deserve any of it. And then, James, the dark shit happened, you know. I don't know how dark you want to get with me on this, but...
As dark as you want to go.
It got really dark really fast, you know.
What was the trigger for getting really dark, though? Was there a moment?
It was timing. I stopped playing hockey, so I no longer had my guys around me, and I needed some new guys around me, and that was hanging out in the clubs in the West End, where we got VIP'd everywhere, and we got our tables, and then all of a sudden, someone introduced me to cocaine, and when you have a cocaine and martini combination, like, you just go nuclear. Like, I already can talk, but you can imagine me on those substances, and man, I was on fire. Like, I was the center of the room, so I thought. You know, that's the illusion of what alcohol and drugs can do. And then probably within like 6 to 18 months, I'd lost everything, you know. And it wasn't a question of people said, you've lost it because you're doing drugs and you're drinking. Everyone was, you know. It was a question of, I wasn't showing up. I was becoming more recluse. You know, the things that I would do for drugs, which was sell stuff. You know, I never stole anything, but I would sell all my furniture and, you know, and I was so brazen, you know, like the things that I would do to go get drugs. I was in Prague once getting drugs, and I had a gun put on my face, a knife to my throat, you know, just to get drugs. So those were dark. That was dark at the time. It got a little bit more dark towards the end, but those were pretty scary moments. And, you know, where I was dicing with death. But then I started
What was going through your mind at the time?
Just to have fun. And, you know, the thing in Prague for an instant was to get drugs for my friends, you know, like, right. I was I was in a club. So, hey, Nick, why don't you go see if you can get some pills? And I went on this little journey asking people for a bunch of pills. And it took me, like, the stuff that I saw was horrible. But, like, you know, you get a gun in your face and a knife at your throat and forced to take, you know, drugs to make sure that you're not a cop. So those are the things that happened in the early stages when you thought it was fun and you thought you were partying, right? But it was dark. And like I said, I started doing this whole geographical cures. I wasn't happy in London because, you know, my girlfriend caught me cheating on her. So she left me. And that at that point, I talk a lot about bereavement, but at 28, 29 years old, when your girlfriend leaves you, who you absolutely adore, you know, and she leaves you because, you know, I'm not faithful, not because I don't love her, but because I want to impress a bunch of guys. So my need to be accepted would make me do heinous things like cheat on my partners. And that's just a horrible place to be, where you're making those kind of decisions of this need to be accepted outweighs the need to be true and honest. And that's all fear based. So, you know, this woman left me and I went into this tailspin of taking drugs because it took the pain away. You know, I took a shot of alcohol and a line of coke and I laughed uncontrollable because her leaving me just went in an instant. You know, I was like, oh my God, this alcohol is a solution. You know, it takes pain away. And that started this 15-year journey of isolation and disconnection and moving countries. And it sounds really glamorous, right? Oh, I moved to LA and then I moved to Canada and then I moved all around Canada, city to city. But I was never more than, like, from say a month to 12 months, I was never in one place longer than that. And I was isolating and drinking longer by myself and finding drugs when I could. You know, having a talent as a TV guy, but not fulfilling my potential, which was horrible. And then, you know, then I ended up back in England. And again, I would build my life up with a production company. Then my day drinking started like it was 24/7 when I needed to drink when I woke up in the morning. And the lies that I would tell my business partner about, you know, I'm going out and I'm getting business meetings I'm helping business build the business, but at home I was sitting with a bottle of vodka watching Frasier on TV in the morning, and that was my breakfast and my start to the day.
It's not even a good TV program.
Oh, come on. The insane thing was, James, is that I would see Frasier have a glass of sherry. Niles, would you like a glass of sherry? And it would be 8:30 in the morning, and that gave me permission to have a
really
vodka, right?
That's extraordinary.
It is, you know, and I remember thinking at the time, I got a problem with this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, even my business partner leaving me again, and then where it gets really dark, and some of the things that I have a hard time admitting is that my mom passed away 8 years ago, just before Christmas. And I managed to stay sober for her funeral. And I spoke at her funeral and then all of a sudden the funeral dies down and everyone goes home. And I end up in my flat in Enfield and James, it was the 21st of December and I bought some Christmas presents for my nieces and nephews. And I had this insane thought that, and I'd been drinking for a week straight. And I had this thought that I had to deliver these presents. So I rented a car, I had it delivered to my house and I drove up the M1 and, you know, I was four times over the legal limit and I got arrested for drink driving and, you know, this should have been a straight to jail sentence. I was a 138 and a 135 in milligrams and a 130 is a jail sentence. And I think about that, James, and I could have killed people, you know, and even the remorse of that, you know, you'd think that would be enough to stop drinking, but the insidiousness of the illness of alcoholism is that when people who don't have it are going like, why don't you just quit?
Yeah.
Show some willpower, show some strength. You were an athlete. You could do that, you know, but the powerlessness over an alcohol or a substance is just, it's powerless. You know, you will drink. And that's what I did. And even with the threat of all the stuff that I had to do, community service and all that, I still kept drinking. Still couldn't stop.
You've described obviously this loss of connection, the accountability to others, and then actually, as this really period of 10 years progressed, in reality, you were battling depression, as I see it. There was this constant hatred. Was it a hatred of yourself, which meant that you wanted others to like you? Because, I mean, it's a similar story with me, to be honest.
I don't know if I would say I hated myself. I think that I was so scared that I became so selfish.
Right.
You know, I became so selfish that it had to be about me, you know, and I became very self-pitying. And I felt like, you know, people owed me. So it was kind of, and the things that I would do too, the manipulation and the cheating and the lying and stuff, those are very selfish behaviors. But I needed to get down to why I was so selfish. You know, why would I, as soon as my community service was done, I just upped and left and went back to Canada again. Another move, right? And then in Canada, build my life up, you know, fall in love, I thought, with another woman and got her pregnant. And, well, we got engaged. She got pregnant. She had a miscarriage. And then I just kept drinking as a solution. And, you know, these are very selfish things. These are things that, you know, I wouldn't say I hated myself, but I looked in the mirror and it wasn't hatred. It was just like, you know, what's going on? It was confusion. I wouldn't, you know, about depression or even alcoholism at that time. And this is only like, say, 7 years ago, you know, and she left me. And then James, this is again happened. Like I drank and drank and drank. I got arrested again. And this wasn't like a drunk tank jail. This is like, oh, we're sending you to prison now, boy. And I spent, you know, some time in a penitentiary in Southern Ontario in an orange jumpsuit and going, how the hell did I get here? And that's the kind of bit where it's not self-hatred. It's like this kind of thing of like, woe is me. How did this nice guy who never hurt anybody all of a sudden with two criminal convictions end up in prison? You know, and that's the insane thought of like, again, depression, mental illness, alcoholism, fear tying into these kind of selfish behaviors.
Tough.
Yeah, you know, tough is tough. It's insane at the time. It's when you think about it now, you know, what got me out of it was I think what everybody is an alcoholic, and there's a lot of people that are going to listen to this and they're not going to relate to me because they're going to have the power to not drink. So they're going to kind of judge and say, you know, it's a lack of willpower. But, you know, what it takes for a guy like me who grows up in the environment, same environment that you did, which is a real man can sort out all his problems. A real man doesn't need to ask for help. You know, a real man can take on the world. You can do anything. You can win. All these things that were just drilled in us as athletes. And those are the thoughts that, you know, you could of masculinity that almost killed me because it wasn't until I was 45 years old, having suffered acute pancreatitis, liver failure, kidney failure. My left eye was blind. I couldn't see out of my left eye. I was so dehydrated and malnourished that I was dying of alcoholism and alcohol poisoning and malnourishment. And then finally just something twigged in me that I asked for help. And it's coming up to 4 years now where those 28th of May, 2016. And I went to a meeting and I asked somebody for help.
What was it like asking for help?
Man, if
emotions attached to that,
so freeing.
So really,
to look at a guy in the eyes who I identified with and just say, help me, you know, help me please. And those words saved my life.
Talking about it?
Well, you know, it's not so much like that you talk about it because when you go into those meetings and in those 12-step programs, everybody's been through the ringer, right? Everyone has their war stories. It's more like, I have a war story too. You know, my sponsor was homeless. You know, he seizured every time he drank. He lost the feelings in his left leg through drinking. So I identified with it. And then once you tell the war story, I've been to prison, I did this, I did that, you know, the insane things that I did. Then you start talking about the solution. And I think this is where, you know, if a guy who is struggling needs to get to where you say, help me, then to know that in any kind of way, you know, whether it's alcoholism or other kind of substance uses or just depression or anxiety, you know, there is a way out where you can identify with someone who's very similar to you. And then there's a lot of programs out there that can help people change. And I think at the base of all of these programs, which is the one that I go to, which set me up to build Retribe, is one of living a life of altruism and principles, where I do not lie, I do not steal, I do not cheat, because I'm not scared. So I worked really hard at, why was I selfish, or the hatred or the pity or whatever? Why was I like that? It was because I was a scared 8-year-old boy who was scared of my father, you know? And then I get to go, I'm not 8 anymore. Mm. My father would be proud of me. My father was an untreated alcoholic who did the best that he could. My mother did the best that she could. I have no need to be scared, you know? And once you're not scared, you're not using these defense mechanisms. And once you're not using these defense mechanisms, you form bonds and friendships of loyalty and honesty. And then that creates the accountability and the incentive. And which I think at our basic human core is this need to be connected. But we live in a world that wants to separate us. Mm. That wants to separate me from you because I need to have a faster car or a prettier girlfriend or a nicer suit or shinier shoes. And these are not true thoughts. These are things that are imprinted upon us by parents, by teachers, by peers, that just are not true.
Talk to me more about what depression and loneliness look like to you, because they're really, in most cases, they're utterly unique in terms of the thought processes, but actually incredibly relatable, because I can relate to you in terms of being scared and actually wanting people to like me. And so I've done things in the past that were ridiculous looking back. But again, that depression, that loneliness is very, very unique. So talk to me a bit more about what that looked like.
Yeah, I suppose the depression and loneliness, are you lonely because you're depressed, or are you depressed because you're lonely, right? Mm. And I think a lot of people nowadays, you can be in a room full of 30 people and you can feel so isolated. And I think that's about relating to people. So loneliness, being alone is okay for me now. The loneliness that I felt was, I'm not with a partner. You know, I don't have someone to cuddle me, to tell me that they love me, to tell me that I'm going to be a father, to tell me that I'm going to be a good husband, to tell me all of the things that again, culture and ideologies put upon me, that by certain ages, I need certain things. So that because I didn't have those things, I hadn't accomplished those things, I felt lonely. I felt different. And then the depression side of things is like, you know, again, depression is like a hard word to define for each person. Like, am I depressed, like with a capital D, like where I'm going to slip my wrist, or capital D depressed, like, you know, I didn't get a pay rise this week. Yeah. I'm not saying that pay rises are not important, but I'm just trying to give you the context, right? And I think a lot of people will stand up, hold up their hands and say, you know, I got a capital D, you know, or at least my day is just not, or my day isn't going through. So there's a spectrum of it. Yeah. And then that depression can make you think that because of the Instagram world and this image based world, that other people are doing better than they are. Right. So I see all my friends on Instagram that are now married, posting pictures of their kids, and their cars and their nice houses. And then I get depressed that I don't have those things. You know, and then again, that separates me from other people. So this brain of ours that does the thinking with all of the
extraordinary thing,
with all of the, and it's pressures that we put ourselves under.
Yeah.
You know, and most of these capital D, small D depressions are put up are our own thoughts that we put on ourselves. They're not true. And I think that we need to go through processes to finding the truth. And to finding that it's okay, and that other people have their struggles too, and it's okay. Mm. And it's okay.
What was your process for dealing with that? Because I think, like to me, I like listening to and well, understanding how people have actually unpacked these sort of things, because I take it away for myself alongside working my own therapist. But what was your process for unpacking them?
So when I asked for help, I needed to have a program that was going to change me, because me by myself, I was limited. I had no power over alcohol. I had no ability to manage my life. I was good at getting things set up, but never good at following through. So what I needed is I needed a structure. Now, the structure that I followed is the 12-step program. So I don't see where it's from because it's got traditions, but people are going to figure it out. Where all 12-step programs started. And that gave me a process. So that gave me acceptance. It gave me willingness, and it gave me courage. It gave me ability to take action. And then when I go through the actions, what I do is I find out about defense mechanisms or character defects. And I find out about fear. And I find out about the conduct that I have had with the opposite sex. And then I look at all of that and I see, you know, where I've been wrong in this world. And James, was I wrong that that I used as an excuse that I was physically and mentally abused by a teacher when I was in grade 3? You know, had nothing to do with me. Like, I was 8. But I carried that around for years. I carried that around for 30 years, you know, 30 odd years, that this thing that around me. And what I did was I got to see that carrying it around was my choice. Mm-hmm. And I had a choice to let it go. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what this program has given me the ability to do is to kind of say, here's all the rubble. Now I'm going to put it here. And then here's a clean slate. And then here are all the people that I've hurt along the way. And I'm going to go and try and fix it. So I take action. It's not just this thing of like sitting in a therapist chair and listening about, you know, my childhood. It's about taking action to fix it. You know, believing that it's going to happen is good, but you physically have got to get your boots on the ground, your hard hat on, and you got to go and repair the shit that you've done in the past. And then living a life of just trying to grow spiritually, trying to grow with my fellow humans, trying not to be an asshole on the street or rude to the girl at the coffee shop because she's not making my coffee fast enough. You know, these tools give me the ability to sit back and to take that breath. Mm. You know, what is now? You know, are things really as bad as they are? No. Mm. What's my fear that's driving that? You know, is that fear real? No. Mm. Am I okay? Yeah. So take the breath and shut the F up. And then, you know, the final step, which is helping people, right? Which is relating to a guy who may just get out of prison. Or relating to a guy who's just been kicked out of his house for drinking too much, or relating to a young fellow who might be drinking too much at university, all different kinds of things that I can say, hey, buddy, you know what? This is what I did when I was at university, even though it wasn't drink, but it was cheating. Here, this is what I do is when I'm talking to people in my industries, like in broadcasting, I shoved drugs up my butt live on air, you know, and they go, whoa. I'll listen to you, you know, and then we create that vulnerability. I'm a place to be judged. People can go, you're an asshole, Nick, for doing that. You're an asshole for drink driving. And but yet some guys are going to say, thank you for being honest with me. Can we sit and have a coffee? And that's what I do now. And, you know, I go into prisons, I go into detoxes, I go into my fellowship and I try to help people. And now, again, I'm so blessed and lucky that I have Retribe because, you know, those 12-step programs have got the market. They're good. But what about the 90% of the people who need connection, you know, who need those kind of same principles? Again, Retribe is all built around us being able to connect, you know, with our humans and go back to our base human instinct. Your question, I keep rambling, so...
No, just connection is a huge part of your life, whereas with other people, whether that might be, I don't know, my initial thought is whether it's to do with being an introvert or an extrovert, but connection is a huge part, really, of your recovery. Why do you think that is?
I think connection is the opposite of isolation, right? And isolation is where addictions and alcoholisms live, so... You need to connect with people on a level that you trust them. And I think that takes a little bit of truth, a little bit of vulnerability, but it's so important to not feel alone. And I think that, okay, let's say I go to a meetup group and it's all about, you know, ping pong. We all are gonna go to a meetup group and we're gonna learn how to play table tennis really well. That's great, because we're there because we wanna learn something, it's an interest. But if we're going to connect with people on a cellular level, on a deeper level, if I go to a group of people who have all been through a divorce in the last year, having problems, custody issue problems, and abusing substances and going to too many strip clubs. Those kind of things are going to identify with a group of people a lot more, and those connections are going to be a lot more solid. And then that creates incentive and accountability where, hey, do you know what, guys, this isn't healthy. This isn't healthy that we're always doing this. What are we going to do about it? And then that's why there's so many great services out there, not only the ones that ReTribe offers, but there's yoga, there's meditation, there's therapy, there's other workshops where people can then attend to together in their little tribe. That's why connection is important, because then you don't feel that ashamed about going somewhere where you know that you need to go to for help.
It makes a lot of sense. For you personally, obviously battling day to day, what kind of things keeps you on an even keel, as it were, or level-headed, where you might feel yourself moving into a space where you don't quite like? That's how I describe it anyway. What kind of things do you do?
You know, I'll change the word, though. I don't battle. I don't battle day to day.
Okay.
Like I slide into my day, and the things that I do that help me are the things that those steps. So there are specific design steps, and these steps are not new concepts. They've been around for a while. They're just redesigned for people with alcoholism. So, but the tools that I have, which is again the ability to take that breath, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of, it's like our perception changes, you know, where we see life out of a certain lens, where I have to have this and I have to have that, rather than what do I need and who can I help. And I think that it's a process. It's like going to the gym, you know, where you start off your day and you have certain five things that you write down that you're going to do, and you try to do them. And then they give you the ability to start, hey, I did those. And you give a sense of accomplishment. But then it's these kind of things about what happens during the day when you're in a line at Starbucks and the woman in front of you is like, you know, doesn't have enough, or she's counting out her change in pennies or something like that. And you get mad. Like you're, come on. But then this is the practice bit where you go, yeah, she's just paying. She's just paying with the money she's got, you know, bless her. Like let just count, take a breath. What's a minute going to cost you in your life? Your coffee's not going to get any colder because it hasn't been made yet.
It's almost like instantaneous reflection, right?
Yeah. Which takes practice.
That does, yeah.
I don't think anybody can go out there and say, oh, I'm spiritually zen right away. I mean, yeah. It takes years of practice. But the idea, James, is to at least have a practice.
Mm.
Have something that you try.
Have something that works.
Yeah, and try different things, but at least keep trying, because you'll find yourself in that same coffee shop a month later, the same thing will happen. But if you at least have some kind of program, and there's thousands out there that you can look at, I guarantee that if you've at least taken some action in trying to make yourself more manageable, then you're not going to get mad.
Mm. We've mentioned the word ReTribe a few times on this podcast episode. And for those listening thinking, what the hell that is Nick's company that he set up with his business partner, which is in the mental health space. Now, I would love you to let me know more about that and what you guys are doing, because it's an interesting company doing some cool stuff.
You know, when I turned 40 years old, that's when I clued up that something happened to me when I stopped playing the sport that I loved. So I wanted to make a documentary series. I was going to call it 40 Down, like 40 years down, right? And I'd been watching Eastbound and Down, that baseball show. And I was like, I'm going to call this thing 40 and Down. And I'm going to take six ex-athletes who were like, and it wasn't even like I was like that at the time, but I was going to take six ex-athletes who were down in the gutter, and I was going to like do that kind of the Biggest Loser transformation and follow these six athletes for a year with these mentors and watch them transform their lives, and everyone cries at the end. But then someone was like, Nick, you know what? That's a good idea, but what people are going to be triggered by this, and they're going to need a platform to go to. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to build the platform. And it got put off and it got put off and it got put off. And then when I got sober at 45 years old, I built ReTribe as a connection app where people could, kind of like a meetup space where people could go to things together. So I formed little tribes with guys that I got sober with, and we started doing things together, like Taco Tuesdays and yoga days and meditation days and meditation Saturdays and going to spin classes. So things that we would do together. And then I wanted to build it into an app and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, it was all ideas. And then I met my business partner, who's a psychotherapist and a social worker. And we decided that we would connect people together. And instead of sending them to yoga classes and meditation classes and gyms, we would actually provide workshops based on her learnings and teachings as a spiritual practitioner, but also a Western practitioner of psychotherapy. And do these kind of programs and these workshops that help people deal with stress and anxiety and loneliness and life in motion and cycles of dependency and grief. You know, all these things that we deal with, we'll be able to get people into a tribe and then attend the workshops together. And that's how, what ReTribe is. And on our website, we say we're an ancient solution to a modern day problem. You know, I've done a lot of reading, like Sebastian Junger and tribes and all the history of tribes and where we come from and why we are the way we are, and why the Western world has more depression than any other part of the world, especially those that are tribal, you know, and the more we have, the more depressed we are. The more we have, the more opiates people are popping. Like, you look at the Midwest in America with the soccer moms, they're just popping those things like Smarties, and they've got everything, you know, but they've got no tribe. And this is the whole thing about what capitalism has put us into, is this compartmentalized us into these mechanics and this machinery where we've lost our purpose, you know. Yeah. And I believe that our purpose for thousands of years of evolution is to help each other survive, you know. Yeah. If we were not part of a tribe, you know, we would have starved, frozen, or gotten eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. So we needed to be in a tribe for survival. And I think we've lost that need to connect on that level.
I would totally agree with you. And it's one of the things that I experienced when I was going through my period of issues recently, was this sense of loss of purpose and meaning. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? I have no idea who I am anymore. What kind of exercises or what kind of things do you say people could do if they wanted to kind of rebalance and reflect and try and repurpose their lives?
First thing to do is you're going to be sitting there listening, well, what's wrong with my life, right? Why am I, is it because I've just split up with somebody? Is it because I've lost my job? Is it because, you know, I'm not pulling my weight at work, or I'm feeling like my colleagues are on me? These are the things that people kind of get into these spirals of depression about, you know, the everyday life things that occur to everybody. So anybody who's going through anything, right, whatever it is, it's big to you, right? It doesn't matter if it's like coming out of prison for drink driving, or just you feel like shit today, you know, maybe you're just having a bad day. The first thing to know is it's okay, and that all of these things are around us to teach us something. Fear is here to teach me something. Normally for me, fear is teaching me that I haven't pulled my weight. You know, I haven't gotten up and I haven't done what I should be doing. And then I get into fear because really I've been lazy. You know, I'm not really doing what I could be doing. So that kind of makes me go into some kind of fear. But what I would say to anybody who's dealing with anything is to recognize it and to ask for help, you know, like no matter how small it is or how big it is, just reach out to somebody and say, you know, I'm having a shit day. Can you talk? And I think when we have a tendency to want to kind of always give our opinions when somebody asks for help. But if you ever receive a call, just listen. No, we don't.
Yeah.
No,
this tendency to feel like you have to offer advice, and when you can't offer advice, you don't think you should take the call at all.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, just listen. And if you recognize it, or if you can accept it, or if you can, you know, relate to any of it, just, oh, you know, I get that too. I feel like that sometimes too.
It's funny though.
Yeah.
Because part of the point about therapy, of course, is actually, well, in particular with counseling, is obviously, you talk, the counselor asks you relatively percolating questions, and you figure out yourself along the way. So Yeah, it's an interesting point.
I found one of the greatest assets that we can have is to be able to listen, you know, to listen to people and just nod. And people don't want us to come up with solutions all the time. It's just a kind ear to listen to. And I think that's really important. So the ability to say help to somebody who's going to understand and not kind of throw a ton of stuff your way, because you ever see, you know, when you've just got a sore throat and you tell someone says, how are you? And you go, oh, I've got a bit of a sore throat. And they're like, oh, you need to go boil some water and put some honey in it and try some echinacea and do all this stuff. Mm. And you're like, dude, I did that. I'm just telling you, I have a sore throat, you know, but this kind of thing that people have this need to kind of throw solutions at our way. And I think that we need to kind of go, hey, like, let's kind of find something that's going to work for you.
Yeah.
And then it's just trying something, just showing up, you know, whether it's for if you're having really problems a lot with substances, then it's a 12-step program, just show up, you know, and identify with somebody, just show up. I think that's such an important thing to do. Is it acceptance? Ask for help and then show up somewhere.
I love that. You were a professional sportsman early doors in your life, and then obviously moved into broadcasting and journalism. For sports people, whether that is amateur or playing a high level amateur sport, or whether even professional sports people listening, like, what's your key message to help with reintroduction to the wider world? Because with a lot of sports people I know, in particular professional rugby, for example, there are people who really struggle with basically assimilating with a normal working job or getting back into life without having to be told that this is what you need to eat, this is where how you need to dress, etc. As somebody's done it, what would you do?
See, with athletes it's tough, because you could be like an elite athlete who got paid tens of thousands of pounds a week to play football, or you could have maybe just been a really good athletics track and field runner, you know, in while you're doing your A-levels. You still had that same love for what you were doing, right? The accolades may have been different, but when you stop playing football and when you stop running, you know, you lose your purpose. You lose that sense, right? And then we start looking for things to fill. And it could be anything from video games to drugs, to women, porn. You know, we look for things to fill. And if you are leaning to some, I think the immediate thing is, am I eating too many donuts today? Why am I doing that? You know, have I watched too much porn? Why am I doing that? You know, and these are the kind of things where you go, what's the hole that I'm trying to fill? And when you stop playing a sport, that's a big, big hole. You know, that's a big hole. And I've found that the only way for that to be filled is to try to place myself into a position to help other people. So, you know, doing some volunteering work and, doing what I do anyway, which really helps me. My job is about helping people. But always remember that there are some people out there who feel like you. You know, I think that's the thing, is like every athlete that stops playing their sports, they think they're the only one. No, I'm the only one that's retired and going through this pain. Whereas literally like tens of thousands of people have been where you are. You know, it's not like you're not unique, but your pain is yours. Mm-hmm. So don't hold on to your pain yourself. Share it. You know, don't be afraid to ask for help and to share your pain and to be with people who stop playing their sport too. And then there's no reason why you can't pick up another sport together, or at least some other activity together. I just started a freaking yoga challenge. You know, I'm 49 years old. And if you ever said to me, Nick, get a yoga mat, I'd be like, that's for like hot girls in Lululemons. And I'm not going to one of those places because I'm too fat. But I started it, you know. Again, it's just this whole idea of showing up. Life is beautiful. And we have phases in our life, you know, and we think that just because we played a sport and may have won something or may have had people adore us and sign autographs or something, we think that that is it. You know, but it isn't. It was then. And life is just as beautiful in the now. You know, we have great memories of the past. Carry the good memories with us. Bring them into the now. Don't worry about the future because it doesn't exist. Most of our fears are about fears of the future. You know, the future doesn't exist, James. Why worry about something that doesn't exist? You know, so you bring the good bits from the past into the now. You don't worry about the future because we can't control it, but you can plan for the next day and how you're going to show up, you know, as a gentleman. And that's what I try to teach the guys that I work with is, like, you know, what do you want to be? You know, if you're not that athlete anymore, or if you're not, you know, that corporate kind of guru anymore, so what do you want to be? I want to be the best guy that I can be by being a gentleman, you know, and I break that into two words. I'd be a gentleman and live a life of principles and honesty and truth. But again, it's really easy to say it. Practicing is a whole lot different, but it's just like the things that we learned when we were athletes, which is, again, I'll say it, just show up, you know, just show up at that pitch, just show up at the tennis court, show up at that ice rink. We just showed up and we're good at it. It became part of our lives. But so many of us, once we stop playing the sport that we love, we think we don't need to show up anymore because there's nowhere to show up to. But that isn't true. You know, you got to show up for your life every day. And, you know, there's the hero's journey. Who wrote the hero's journey again? I can't even remember. It's off the top.
I don't know. I haven't read it, so you're on your own with this one.
Yeah, but I quote it and talk about it all the time. But you know, YouTube, the hero's journey. There's a beautiful documentary about it, and how we can become, you know, the heroes of our own life. You know, which is about, it's about us going through a cycle. It's about us having a fellowship of people around us. It's about us sharing all of our experiences with people and then helping others. And I think that's just a beautiful thing. Life is amazing. Mm. Live in the now, live in today.
Nick, I asked this question to almost everybody that comes on the podcast, which is, why did you want to come on the podcast in the first place? Interested to hear your view on that.
Yeah, I just, like, you know what? Part of my daily routine is just to let go. Right. And I just say, universe, guide me in any way that you can have me be to help me be useful and help with others. And then we have a common friend who, you know, they know my story and they're like, okay, that's cool. And then they hooked us up, you know, and we're both in the early stages of us trying to set something up that we can, you know, create awareness to help people. So, you know, I wanted to kind of come on board, tell you my story, but also say that creating awareness is amazing. It's beautiful. Mm. And it's connection and it's accountability and it's acceptance and all that kind of stuff. And it's now, so I've come on here to kind of say to guys, like, you know, if you need some solutions and you need a program and stuff, then Retribe could be good for you. So, you know, you can get in touch with me and maybe we can start taking action, you know, which is what you're doing, right? You're taking action to try to create awareness to people so that they can then take action themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I think that telling stories is amazing, but at the end of it, has somebody out there, one person resonated with my story, and will that one person be brave enough to say, I'm going to reach out, you know, and just say, hey, you know, and then the beautiful things can happen. So that's why I do these things, is just to kind of tell my story, tell people that they're not alone, reach out if you want to talk, because I'm pretty good at listening. And then I'm also pretty good at going for coffees and just talking and saying that it's okay and I get it. And what are we going to do about it?
Well, when lockdown's over, we must go grab a coffee and chat about it. Where can people find you?
Yeah. So I think the best way, like, email me, Nick, N-I-C-K at re-tribe.com. That's Nick at re-tribe.com, or Nick Rothwell. I'm on Facebook, or Nick Rothwell 24 on Instagram. Yeah. Just find me. I'm sure when you put this out, you can put a link somewhere too.
Yeah, I'll do. I'll stick them in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah, my email address is really cool. Nick@re-tribe.com.
Awesome. Look, Nick, thank you so much. It's been an awesome 50 minutes or so. And a bit longer than that. I mean, I've taken away a lot from this. So it's good for my recovery. But I'm sure there's going to be loads of people who can relate. So thanks so much for your time.
Amazing, brother. Thank you so much. Be well and stay safe.
Take care.
Hey guys, thanks for listening, supporting the podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn through @TheRutPod for more updates on who's coming up next on the show. Special thanks to my team Ricky Batchu and Phil Bateman who helped me produce The Rut. Next time on The Rut, I sit down with European and Premiership winner Will Fraser. One of the most remarkable episodes I've had the pleasure of doing so far. See you then.